Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. And finally today, we want to remember architect Henry Cobb, who is credited with transforming Boston's modern skyline. He died in Manhattan on Monday at 93 years old. Cobb was a partner at Pei Cobb Freedon Partners, a firm he helped found along with architect I.M. Pei in the 1950s. A Boston native, he had graduated from Harvard's Graduate School of Design in 1949, where he actactually studied under Walter Gropius, founder of the Bauhaus School. We spoke with Cobb in December, and he told us that soon after graduation, all he wanted to do was get out of Boston.
When I left on April 1st, 1950, I had come to the conclusion that nothing of interest to me was going to happen in Boston during my lifetime. Boston itself was not very receptive to the new architecture, as Gropius called it. The irony is that having gotten away from Boston, I've done more work in Boston than in any other city.
And indeed, he is the architect behind the harbor towers at the waterfront, the Moakley Courthouse in the seaport, and most recently, One Dalton near the Prudential. But the building that he believes he had the biggest impact with was the John Hancock Tower in Back Bay, now officially named 200 Clarendon Street.
Before that, Boston was very uncomfortable with tall buildings, and after that, it became much more comfortable with tall buildings. And I like to think that the Hancock Tower had something to do with a greater acceptance of tall buildings.
Now, the Hancock Tower's construction caused a great deal of controversy in the 1960s and 70s over the idea of a corporation getting to build a modern glass tower that overshadowed Boston's iconic Trinity Church and Copley Square. There were also some engineering flaws and those faulty windows that kept falling out. In the end, all 10,334 panes of glass had to be replaced. All that led to major delays in the completion of the tower. But when we spoke with him, Henry Cobb told us that he remained steadfast in his belief that the Hancock Tower was an essential building for Boston at that time.
My argument was that Copley Square had already been seriously damaged by things happening around it that made it seem irrelevant, like the Prudential Tower, and by the opening up of the turnpike, which destroyed part of the enclosure of the square. And I argued that for Copley Square to recover its meaning, or perhaps find a new meaning, it needed to find a way to embrace rather than reject the new scale. And of course, I was very much interested in that problem before then, in the problem of how cities can grow and accept tall buildings in a way that is not damaging to older buildings, but actually works in concert with them. And in the case of Trinity Church and the Hancock Tower, the tower is designed in such a way that the church is reaffirmed as the center of a composition, whereas the tower is very much a peripheral element. And the fact that the tower respects the church and speaks to the church and to the square is, I think, what made the building quite enthusiastically accepted as soon as it was finished.
Harry, do you argue that the Hancock building is now widely accepted? I feel like I still hear and read criticism and controversy over the presence of that building and how it affected the architectural landscape of Boston.
I think it is still controversial. I mean, some people will never like the idea of tall buildings or contemporary buildings in the context of historic buildings. But I believe that one of the major challenges for architecture today is to find a way to make tall buildings that speak to the space of the city, to the life of the city, to the historic buildings in the city. And in the case of the Hancock Tower, the reason it is largely accepted is because people recognize that its gesture, its material, its minimalism is designed to complement Trinity Church, to celebrate Trinity Church.
In your book, Words and Works, 1948 to 2018, you talk about a set of questions that you say you ask yourself when you're creating something. One being, does this tower belong in that city? And you go on to say that the answer should be both yes and no to that question. That seems like the question that must have been at play between the Hancock Building and Trinity Church. How did you and do you go about answering that question for yourself?
The best way I can explain it is with an analogy to a statement that Yeats made once. I think it's approximately this. When men argue with others, they create rhetoric. When they argue with themselves, they create poetry. Hancock is as close as I've ever come to poetry, and it's precisely because it is, in a sense, raising questions about itself. So the fact that it's still controversial and the fact that it's kind of become iconic in Boston, the one thing that I would say that I'm a little bit cautious about is that I think tall buildings get too much of a play today everywhere. And part of the impoverishment of the city that we've seen is owing to a kind of onslaught of tall commercial and even tall residential buildings, whereas little attention is paid to buildings that have great cultural significance. That's why, for me, if you ask me what is my most important built work in Boston, I would say the Moakley Courthouse. For me, the experience of designing that building was much richer, so we say, than the experience of designing Hancock. Hancock is, just by definition, a one-liner. Now, it's a very refined one-liner, but the courthouse is not a one-liner. It has a very interesting story to tell.
I'd like to talk about the courthouse for a minute, Harry. In looking at it, it was completed 20 years ago. One can certainly argue that the seaport area beyond it doesn't even resemble what it did 5 years ago, let alone 20 years ago. If the Moakley Building was an imagination or an invitation, and I understand those are my words, not yours, but an imagination or an invitation for how the area around it might emerge architecturally, I think one would have to argue that the Seaport District did not emerge architecturally in a way that was responsive to the invitation offered by the Moakley Courthouse. How do you feel about how the Seaport's architecture has emerged? And is it what you would have preferred or envisioned when you de facto anchored that area with the design of the courthouse itself?
Well, of course, when the courthouse was built, there was nothing there, many blocks around. And the courthouse was designed to affirm a kind of harmony with the historic buildings, warehouse buildings that now converted to office in the neighborhood, near Fort Point Channel. And, I was determined to show that the courthouse could, in fact, assert itself as a truly public building in a public space. So what happened around it, what bothers me a little bit is that the public space infrastructure of the Seaport District is not as exciting, not as wonderful as it could have been and should have been, because you were starting from scratch. I mean, it was an extraordinary opportunity.
There have been several times in our conversation, Harry, where you have brought out the idea of public access. One of the things that struck me in the book, you studied under Walter Gropius, founder of the Bauhaus movement, led the architectural program at Harvard when you were there. You talked about his complaint about your thesis proposal, which was a set of residential towers down in the wharf area. He criticized that they were for the rich and not for everybody. You were the architect for One Dalton Place, which also received some criticism about being, there for the extremely wealthy. We are struggling with income inequality, equal access to housing, affordable housing, access to green space and public amenities in Boston today. What do you think the role of architects and architecture are in assuring public access and some layer of access to equal opportunity in design in a city like Boston?
Well, there are two issues that have to be addressed. One is programmatic, and the other is design. Programmatically, the way the city has addressed the issue is by requiring every new project, every new residential project, to include a certain percentage of affordable housing. And One Dalton is no exception to that. But Boston and most American cities have failed to find a satisfactory formula for achieving it. That's a programmatic issue. The other one is an issue of design. This is where the architect can and should intervene. If you ask me what is the most important single element in the One Dalton project, I would say it's the small park that we've created at the end of St. Germain Street. That park, that mediating element of the park, is crucial because it's a shared space. It's not exclusive. It's public. The fact that there's a tower rising above it is a market-driven phenomenon, but it's complicated. Building in the city is really complicated.
As architecture evolves, as any form of art evolves, change happens. Is there both either a need or a responsibility to preserve some of the past in that evolution? Or contrarily, is it necessary to destroy pieces of the past in order to make way for that evolution?
It's bound to be a bit of both. But you have to be very careful about which is which. There are some situations in which you have to break eggs to make an omelet. But they are relatively rare. I'm a really big believer in place and occasion, the specific place and the specific occasion. And I'm a big believer in architecture as fragments of the city. You have to see a building. A building should never be thought of as just an autonomous object. That's the problem with many tall buildings. A building should always be speaking to what's around it.
I'd love to ask you one more question. Mm-hmm. Your dear friend and business partner, I.M. Pei, passed away earlier this year, and I want to acknowledge your loss. I'm sorry for it. You were equal partners in the firm. You had very different approaches to your work. Looking back, what is one of the most important lessons you learned from I.M. Pei?
What can one say? I.M. Pei is someone whose judgment I always listen to. He has an extraordinary eye, and going with it, he has quite an extraordinary ambition or a desire to break through into new territory. We worked together for 40 years. I would never pretend that he learned much from me, but I continued to learn from him.
That's architect Henry Cobb, speaking with us in December. Cobb was a founding partner of Pei, Cobb, Fried & Partners. He died Monday in Manhattan at the age of 93.